Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Full of lies. That's how the Syrian government is characterizing American intelligence reports that the Assad regime has used chemical weapons, killing 150 people. President Obama said yesterday that the regime crossed a red line and he has committed to providing small arms to Syrian rebels, whereas Senator John McCain has called for more, a no-fly zone over Syria. But will that be enough? Aaron David Miller joins us on the line. He served as a Middle East advisor for Republican and Democratic secretaries of state from 1980 to 2003, and we should note that the line's a little rough. But, Mr. Miller, first and foremost, what will the U.S. send to the rebels?
They're not going to provide anti-aircraft weapons, so-called man pads, because who knows where these weapons could ultimately be found, used against an Israeli civilian airliner, for example, should they fall into the wrong hands. So the administration will proceed very carefully, beginning with light arms, ammunition, personal weapons, probably RPGs. They might well go to anti-tank weapons. It's just that the assumption, I think, of most military planners in the Obama administration is that nothing the administration is prepared to provide is going to fundamentally alter the nature of the conflict. That is to say, they will not be able to give the weapons or will not give the rebels weapons to either defeat the regime or force it to the negotiating table.
Is that the Obama administration's goal, though, to fundamentally alter the conflict?
If there is a strategic objective, it is to level the playing field, enhance the opposition's capacities, push the regime and the Russians and the Iranians into a situation where they'd be forced to negotiate along the already prescribed Geneva process. No one is talking about the deployment of thousands, let alone hundreds of thousands of American forces. What is it that the administration thinks it can achieve? Is it looking to begin a proxy war fought by the United States and Saudi Arabia and the Qataris on one hand against Hezbollah, the Russians, and the Iranians on the other with the regime in tow? Or is it an effort, and I think it's the latter, is it an effort to put enough pressure to essentially buck up the opposition to force what is now a military conflict into a political process? I suspect it is the latter.
Huh. Now, politically, what do you make of the timing of this decision? Because we mentioned Senator McCain. I mean, he's also in recent days said that the Assad regime is winning the conflict in Syria. How much of the rhetoric in Washington do you think went, you know, informed the president's decision to at least begin with small arms assistance?
Look, it's a second-term president. Nobody is going to understand when Obama leaves the White House, it would seem to me, even while there is no public support right now for any proactive policy on Syria. But no one is going to understand, I think, once 2016 rolls around, why this president couldn't have done more. Why couldn't he have done something? And I think that calculation, presidents look at their legacies in the second term, that calculation is weighing more heavily on the administration. That's part of it. Plus, the reality is this is going to get worse before it gets worse. Something is going to happen which is likely going to force the administration into greater involvement.
I'm just wondering where you see this heading next for President Obama.
It seems to me that at some point, probably in the fall, the Obama administration will reach a decision point. Are they going to continue a policy of providing minimum amounts of weaponry, or will they be pushed into a position in order to protect their credibility to do something more, to use either their own air power for strikes against leadership targets or military assets, or a no-fly zone, and without a lot of luck, the administration risks the possibility of being drawn in a way it really wants to avoid.
Now, Mr. Miller, political issues aside, I'm wondering, based on your long experience in foreign policy, do you think any military involvement at all is a wise move for the United States in Syria?
I've argued repeatedly, and I'm not insensitive to the humanitarian, moral, and strategic interests that the United States has. I do not believe, however, after Iraq and Afghanistan, the two longest wars in American history, as a taxpayer, I don't want America getting stuck with a check for Syria.
And yet thousands more, as you yourself have said, are likely to die there by the end of the summer.
Yes, and I would cite Rwanda, and I would cite Congo. We cannot fix the world. And unless the president is determined to declare that ending this civil war and taking the lead role in helping to create a new Syria is a vital national interest, it seems to me he has wisely and willfully pursued a strategy to try to stay out of this.
Aaron David Miller is vice president for new initiatives and a distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Mr. Miller, thank you so much.
Terrific to be with you.
Let's turn now to a problem that many Americans face, heart disease, which kills almost 1 million Americans every year. That's the daunting reality facing our next guest. Paul Eisenstein is the 60-year-old publisher of thedetroitbureau.com, and we normally talk to him about cars, but it turns out that Paul is like many middle-aged Americans for another reason. After his doctors did some tests, they told him he had high cholesterol and he was at risk of a heart attack. But it wasn't just that. Paul's father, grandfather, and uncle all died from heart attacks before they were 60. Still, Paul ignored his doctor's advice. Then last summer, he started feeling unusually fatigued, and we'll let Paul take it from here. He joins us from Detroit. And Paul, so you were feeling tired, but what else?
Well, I was approaching 60, which I just turned a little over a month ago, and I was starting to feel all the things that you try to think are just related to age. Walks become more difficult. Life becomes more difficult. You even have to give yourself a little bit of a shove to get out of a chair. You just feel tired and worn down. And you say, oh, I'm turning 60. That must be the problem.
Sounds about right. And so what made you think that maybe it was more than just the turning 60 factor?
Well, as I approached my birthday, my wife and I took a trip abroad. And we went all over Europe. And we did what we like to do normally, which is to walk. Except I was finding myself getting more and more tired on even shorter and shorter walks. Worse, just before I came back, I noticed that I was getting real bad swelling in my calves, ankle, and feet. And it got horrible. I looked like a balloon when I came back. And that got me thinking, there's something wrong. I guess I started listening to my body. I had another trip to go on, another assignment to China, and I decided to call both my regular doctor and a cardio I had used a few years ago. And they said, if you're going to China, you don't want to have a heart attack at 40,000 feet. Get to the hospital, get tested now.
So you did that, right? And what happened? What'd they find?
Well, I went through a couple tests, and the first ones were good. I did not have a heart attack. It appears I never did have one, which is nice because I'm already 14 years beyond where my father survived. He died at 46. But as they continued the tests, the results turned out to be bad. I have to tell you, one of the worst things you can imagine is having a doctor walk into your room and saying, Paul, I have to tell you, you have serious heart disease.
What did they do? Did they let you leave the hospital?
Well, they offered me some options, and I have to tell you, I shook. I shook enough to rattle fillings out of my teeth for about an hour. It really was, to me, initially a death sentence. I had no idea what I was going to deal with. All the males in my family died at very young ages, and I lived already beyond that, and I did not know if that meant I wasn't going to survive. So I had to think about it. They gave me a few minutes, and then they basically came back and said, now, that could be a mistake. You could go to China. We'd recommend you have a stress test tomorrow, or the best thing to do would be to wait till Monday, cancel your trip, and go in for a what they call a catheterization, where they stick basically a long needle, if you will, inside of you, or tube, with a camera at the other end that they can look and actually see if the initial diagnosis is correct.
Mm, and so I imagine that when they did that, they saw some pretty serious heart disease, and they confirmed it, right?
Yeah, they did. One artery was pretty much blocked. Another one wasn't bad. They'll be watching that, in fact, jumping ahead in the story. The third, which was really the critical one, sometimes called the widowmaker, well, that one, when they went in, what they found were, you might call them arteriosclerosis speed bumps. Six, in fact, bump, 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 70% blockage.
And so you ended up with six stents, I understand.
Exactly. And that's the amazing thing, is that they were able to go in and not just look, but they were able to do the procedure at the same time.
Now, Paul, I've got to ask, I mean, before any of this happened, you went in and had tests done on your heart. What were you told by doctors then?
Well, curiously enough, I actually had two tests back to back, one by my regular doctor who does have some heart monitoring equipment. And his test was really bad. It showed I had had a silent heart attack and all sorts of things. But there was a potential problem with his equipment, which was a little out of date. So he sent me to a cardio, and that cardio ran additional tests, actually duplicated the tests with much newer equipment and did several tests on top of that. That result said, A, I didn't have a heart attack. B, I didn't have blockage. Yes, I had serious cholesterol issues, but I thought I had gotten a get-out-of-jail-free card at that point because, yes, my cholesterol was bad, but he didn't see anything that indicated that I was having a heart problem.
Okay, so nothing that maybe would have encouraged you to make major changes in your lifestyle, even though your father, your grandfather, and your uncle have a deep family history of heart attacks.
Yes, I do, but they also smoked like chimneys. I also did have an aunt who lived to 95. Now, she also smoked, by the way, like a chimney. She never had a problem. She worked to the day she died at 95, and my mother was in pretty good shape, so I was hoping maybe I got the other genes.
I see. And so we know you as being a man who travels a lot and is a foodie as well. And you maintained both those aspects of your lifestyle all the way up until the recent installation of these stents, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'd love to eat and I love to eat well. I was unfortunately really taking the risk. Not only was I ignoring the advice about the statin drugs, I was also eating too much, I was sleeping too little, I was traveling and running, and I was being a little pig, and I was putting on a lot of weight. I went from, 6 years ago, being a bit over 200 to over 250 by the time I went into the hospital.
Paul, hang in here for just a second, because you mentioned that we have a doctor with us, and we do. We've got Dr. Christopher Cannon. He's a cardiologist at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and he joins us. Dr. Cannon, welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
So Paul's story is sadly probably familiar to a lot of people, and he's got a couple really good lessons for us all to learn here. One is to listen to your body, which we'll talk about more in a moment. But the other is the question of the nature of the initial heart tests that he had several years back. So it seems like those tests may have some limitations.
Well, they do. I think the classic thing that's done is a stress test. It sounds like he unfortunately had a poor quality one and then had a good one. It tells whether there's a 70% or more blockage at that time, but it doesn't say if you have blockages that are in the process of building up, as we might suspect.
But it tells you if you have 70% or more at that time?
Right.
Okay, but what about if you have less?
Then it wouldn't show up, and so he very likely had all those ones that were 60% a few years later were probably 30 or 40, and so that process of cholesterol building up in the arteries had very likely started a decade before, but is missed by a typical stress test.
We're talking to cardiologist Christopher Cannon and reporter and heart disease sufferer Paul Eisenstein. We'll have more in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about the perils of not listening to your body or your doctor. Two lessons reporter Paul Eisenstein recently learned. Paul's father, grandfather, and uncle all died of heart attacks before the age of 60. Doctors told Paul he needed to reduce his cholesterol level, advice he ignored until one day he felt unusually fatigued, visited the hospital, and found out he needed 6 emergency heart stents. Paul is with us, and so is Dr. Christopher Cannon, cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And Dr. Cannon, Paul had a stress test and an EKG, but given his risk factors, what other tests could have been done?
Well, another alternative is to actually look at the arteries. That can be done the most simply with what's known as a calcium score. And so it's a CT scan, very low radiation, that looks, is there calcium in the heart area? if there's cholesterol, there's calcium right next to it. And so the more calcium you see, the more blockages are in the heart arteries. A fancier version of that can be done as a CT angiogram where you actually get the exact percent. But the decision for people like Paul 4 years ago would be, should I get aggressive in treating, losing weight, exercising, taking my statin, probably taking aspirin as well, so that you need to know, is the process started or not? He didn't have any symptoms at the time, so the stress test would check our symptoms from the heart. We want to know, is the cholesterol building up or not? If so, then to treat it.
Dr. Cannon, it sounds like these calcium tests are more sophisticated tests, possibly more costly. Are they being done enough on enough patients with potential heart disease?
Well, no. I think they've, as any new test that costs money, the insurance companies don't want lots of tests happening that they have to then pay for that would be done in people that don't need them. But for the right patient like Paul, I think this could have been a real change of the game 4 years ago.
Yeah. So what really gets me is something that Paul said earlier, that because of the initial EKG and stress test, which didn't show anything that raised an immediate red flag, Paul used a wonderful language. He felt like he was a get-out-of-jail-free card, so there was no encouragement for him to change his lifestyle. That is a potential risk, it sounds like, for other people who are in Paul's situation, that there's no indication that they should do anything to live a healthier lifestyle, even if they have a profound family history of heart disease.
Well, that's the thing. It's false security that you're okay. And so this is where trying to understand, is the problem there or not? And then do I really need to get serious? There was one study 2-3 years ago that did the calcium score in half the patients and the other half got just standard treatment. And those who got the calcium score actually got on medicines more often. Their blood pressure was lower, their cholesterol was lower, all the risk factors went down because they had seen problems and they got serious.
Paul, how are you feeling today?
I feel wonderful. Within an hour after having the stents installed, people were remarking on the color that I had in my face that they hadn't seen in years. I am able to work out. And what's interesting is almost on a daily basis, I notice improvements in my stamina, in the ability to lift, and how far I can bike, and so on. I've also lost over 20 pounds. I'm losing a little less than a pound a day in just a month. This really motivated me, that change in my behavior and in the way I feel is remarkable. And the better I feel, the more confident and comfortable I feel about doing things like exercising. Seeing myself being able to do a 3-mile heart walk this past weekend has made me feel so good about what's happening with my body. Suddenly, 60 doesn't feel like the end of my life. It feels like the beginning.
You're a passionate foodie. A lot of that had to be tough to give up.
In some cases, I've had to give up things. I can't eat fried foods. That's one thing I'm just not touching. So those fried oysters and soft shell crabs are gone. But a lot of things I can do, and it may just mean that I have one bite or two. If you try to completely give up everything, you're probably likely to backslide and eventually just let it go and go back to your old ways. If you really, really cut back and occasionally allow yourself a treat, you're more likely to stick with it.
So Dr. Cannon, it seems like one of the big takeaways from this is, you know, it's not an unfamiliar one in medicine, that patients do need to actually be their own advocates in the doctor's office. So what should we be asking our doctors?
Well, the Framingham risk score is the first step that we sort of add up all the risk factors. And so asking your doctor, what is my heart risk? And then asking, are there other tests that would help sort out? I have a bad family history, and it's a pretty common scenario. Is that as a reason at age 40 or 50 to come get checked out? Should there be other tests? And what about a calcium score? Would that help change my treatment?
Well, Dr. Christopher Cannon is a cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Thank you so much, Dr. Cannon.
Well, thank you.
And Paul, last question for you. For folks who are listening to this, what do you want to tell them?
Listen to your body. And if you have a genetic history, don't ignore it. The good part is, the sooner you deal with this, the easier it is to adapt. You really can take charge of your life and, if necessary, get the treatment that will give you a lot more stamina and give you a lot longer life.
Well, Paul Eisenstein is the publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. Paul, here's to many, many, many healthy and happy years in front of you.
Thank you so much. Good to be with you.
So speaking of health and eating, a couple of weeks ago we had a conversation about a new food supplement called Soylent.
Soylent Green is people!
Okay, so that was from the 1972 Charlton Heston film. But in our original interview, Rob Reinhart, the creator of Soylent, the food substitute, said obviously his creation is not people, and he's kindly sent us a sample, and I've got it here. So I'm going to try it. It has the look and feel and smell of cake batter. It smells just like it, and it's a pale yellow powder. So first, you're supposed to put some water in a bottle. Got that. And then a couple spoonfuls of the Soylent powder. And now put the lid on and mix. Okay, so here I go. I'm going to try Soylent, Rob Reinhart's creation. Well, I have to say, it's not bad, although I'm not sure I'm going to be giving up my salads for it just yet. You can hear our original interview with Rob Reinhart at hereandnow.org. The news is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The ICA with Barry McGee. Vibrant paintings and installations capture the energy of the street in this 20-year retrospective on view now. ICABoston.org. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. Summer.harvard.edu.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've got more now on the massive Black Forest fire near Colorado Springs. Incident Commander Rich Harvey delivered this update at Pikes Peak Community College earlier today.
We feel last night we had a good operation. We didn't lose any real ground. We didn't lose any structures. We're pretty optimistic about the day, but we're also very cognizant of the weather forecast, very cognizant of what can happen to us, so we're being cautious.
Now, part of that caution includes evacuation orders, which remain in place. More than 40,000 people have left their homes. The Black Rock Fire has scorched more than 15,000 acres, making it the most destructive fire in Colorado history, and at least two people have died. Colorado Public Radio reporter Ben Marcus was at that update. And Ben, what else did Rich Harvey tell you?
Well, they made a lot of progress last night, you know, digging lines, a perimeter around the fire to get containment. But they don't want to move that 5% containment number yet because so much work was done at night. They want to see the work they've done in the light of day and the heat of day to see if those lines hold up. And he's optimistic. If they do, they're going to have a bigger containment number later in the afternoon.
Now, Rich Harvey, the incident commander, mentioned that they're looking at the weather forecast. We know there's been some welcome cloud cover, but what are the concerns about the weather tomorrow and over the weekend or the rest of the weekend?
It's wind. Wind is the biggest problem because that makes fighting the fire very hard on the firefighters, because if the wind is changing, it goes north, east, west, south, it can be dangerous for the firefighters. It can be dangerous for the people who are trying to assess damage, too. There's a lot of anxious homeowners that want to know if their home has burned to the ground or not. So it's that wind that they're really going to keep their eye on. But it's cloudy. It's staying cool right now. Hopefully it stays that way.
Now, Colorado Springs, which is very near where this fire is burning, it's a major city in the state of Colorado, also a significant military community. Fort Carson is there, the Air Force Academy, and other bases. And the local paper there, the Gazette, is reminding us that the military community has been helping fight this fire. So how have they been doing that in what has to be a huge operation?
The Lieutenant Colonel of the National Guard, he says this is the Battle of Black Forest, this fire. And from where I'm standing at the command center, I count three helicopters in the air, all providing air support. There were fixed-wing aircraft yesterday flying over, dropping fire retardant and water. This is the closest you can get to a war zone in America here, and that's what the incident commanders are saying. We've been planning for this since Waldo Canyon was a huge blaze that hit Colorado Springs a year ago. And so they've been meeting military, civilian firefighters, national firefighters. They've been meeting for 3 weeks before this. So they were as ready as you could possibly be for this. 700 firefighters are on the ground right now. That's huge.
Yeah, the manpower and machine power that it must require to fight such a huge blaze almost defies the imagination. But Ben, on the flip side of things, you know, as we said earlier, 40,000 people have left their homes in order to stay safe. And we've been seeing concerns about possible looting in the area. So what's the mood like? And have we been able to confirm that there's been any looting?
Yeah, those concerns of looting are really founded from last year during Waldo Canyon, when they had to prosecute several people who went in and looted homes during that big fire last year. And so people are really concerned about that. And that's where the Army National Guard really comes into play. They have Humvees and they are patrolling, and they are largely a security presence on the ground. The lieutenant commander here said he had a hard time even getting to his home, which is in the evacuation area, if that gives you any sense of how tight security is there.
Now, Ben, we've just got about 30 seconds to go here, but I do have to ask you about the fact that there are so many homes in this area. The Western Governors Association has been reported through the AP as saying local governments have authority where homes are placed. So in a couple seconds, if you can, is there yet again a renewed debate about zoning laws?
There certainly will be. You know, part of the problem is Colorado is an anti-tax state. The way that local governments can get tax revenue is by getting property taxes, and that means siting homes sometimes in that wildland urban interface that can be dangerous.
Well, Ben Marcus is a reporter for Colorado Public Radio, reporting to us on the massive forest fires that are going on there. Ben, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Well, coming up, we'll speak with NPR host Steve Inskeep about the elections in Iran. He's in Tehran today. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. It's here and now. Long lines are being reported at some polling places in Tehran as Iranians vote in the first presidential election since the 2009 disputed election of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. That election led to widespread protests and a violent government crackdown. NPR's Steve Inskeep has been reporting from Iran this week, and he joins us from Tehran. Hi there, Steve.
Glad to be back on the program.
So today is election day in Iran. What have you seen so far?
Well, we began the day by watching Iran's supreme leader vote, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He is not elected by the people, but by a small group of elites. He was chosen more than two decades ago to succeed Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of Iran's revolution. And he's actually more powerful than the guy who is being elected today, the guy that he voted for. He dropped a ballot in a plastic box. He also made a statement, which was rather provocative. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that U.S. officials have criticized the rather limited range of candidates in Iran's presidential election, and he used a Persian expression, a Farsi expression, that translates the hell with them.
Now, that limited list, it's roughly eight candidates or even fewer now. It began at 600. So I'm wondering if you've been able to speak with any regular Iranians and what they say about that limited list. Do they feel that they like the selection that's in front of them?
Oh, absolutely. There are some Iranians who will defend the system. They'll say, look at your system in the United States. You only have two parties. But there are also people who are greatly disappointed, who had candidates they wanted to support, many of whom seemed qualified, one of whom was a former president, who were not allowed to run because another small group of Iranian leaders decided that they were not qualified to run. But with that said, Meghna, let me mention that also today I've been going around to some polling places, and there's a fair number of people who are either excited by the possibility of one candidate or another, or who at least feel that an important choice is being made here in Iran. Again, the clerics have ultimate power. Whoever is elected president has limited power. But you have a candidate like Saeed Jalili, who is Iran's nuclear negotiator, who is positioning himself very much as a hardline conservative who wants to continue resisting the United States, using a culture of resistance, actually, is his phrase, against economic sanctions, U.S.-led economic sanctions that are really devastating Iran. There are other people who have said one of their most vital concerns is the economy, and another of their most vital concerns is better better relations with the world, and that includes people who've said to us in front of a microphone on tape they want better relations with the United States. That can be something of a daring thing to say here, but it's a widespread view, and I think it's a view that's held by some of the elites as well as people on the street.
This is really interesting, Steve, because in your reporting, I've also heard you say that people in Iran feel that they can speak more freely during election season than perhaps at other times of the year. So I wonder, do you get any sense from average Iranians that you're speaking to at polling places, is there sufficient discontent or concern over the possible outcome of this election such that we might see street protests like the ones we saw after the election of President Ahmadinejad in 2009?
You know, I don't see any sign of street protests yet. And first, we really ought to wait and see what the result of the election is. It could be that people will end up very happy with this result, or at least not too dissatisfied with the result. But there was immense hope that a reformist candidate would be elected in 2009. Mousavi, the candidate, the leading candidate of that year, appeared to be the favorite. And then suddenly, very abruptly, very early on election night, was declared the loser in favor of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And so people rode a very high wave of hope, and then the wave crashed on the beach, and there was great disappointment that led to many, many, many months of protests and then a violent repression by the government. I don't think there's a lot of optimism this time around. There's actually a lot of quiet. There's a lot of people who have said that they're just not interested in voting this time. And in fact, this has gotten to the point where reform forces have been urging their people to come to the polls. Don't let the conservatives win by default. And at the same time, Iran's supreme leader has been urging people to get out and vote because he would like to send a message, he says, to outside powers, especially the United States, that the people are behind him.
Steve, you mentioned the sanctions, particularly the U.S. sanctions, that are having a crippling effect on Iranians and the country. But are they having the intended effect on the government?
I think it is reasonable to say that they have had the effect of dividing Iran's elites. There are many people who seem to think it is time to negotiate a deal, not surrender to the United States. But at the same time, I want to stress there are a lot of people in the elites, and we can probably count Iran's supreme leader among them, who deeply, profoundly distrust the United States, who suspect that they couldn't get a good deal from the United States even if they were willing to make one, and who feel that they have to push on and somehow weather this storm. And they still might for a while, because as you drive around Tehran, it's clear that while vast numbers of people are suffering, middle-class people feel they're sliding into poverty, there are also people who make a lot of money in hard times, and you see evidence of that as well.
NPR's Steve Inskeep has been reporting from Iran this week, speaking to us today from Tehran. Steve, thank you so much.
Happy to help.
And now a story to mark Father's Day. This Sunday, thousands of people in Evanston, Illinois, will take part in the 14th annual Race Against Hate, which honors Ricky Birdsong. He was the first African-American coach of the men's basketball team at Northwestern University. In 1999, a member of a white supremacist group murdered Birdsong while he was jogging with two of his three children. On this Father's Day weekend, Here and Now's Alex Ashlock remembers Coach Birdsong and the impact he had on him and his son.
In the summer of 1996, when my son Casey was 10, we went to the father-son basketball camp at Northwestern University. Casey was a basketball junkie just like me, so it was a thrill for both of us. The highlight of the weekend was getting to play on the court where the Wildcats played their games. Coach Birdsong was with us. We had a blast. All of the kids running around like crazy, the dads trying not to get hurt. I remember thinking, here was this Big Ten basketball coach, and he was spending his Saturday night playing ball with my son and me. His daughter Kelly says that sounds familiar.
He was so busy, but he always found time to take us to Northwestern and shoot around with us every Sunday. He'd take a lot of my friends and I to the park in our neighborhood and shoot around.
The Race Against Hate on Sunday benefits the work the Evanston North Shore YWCA does to promote racial equality. That's a big issue. What I will think about on Father's Day is something smaller. Another dad shooting baskets with my son and me.
Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. And by the way, to all the fathers out there, happy Father's Day. Stick with us, because before we go today, marketing the Man of Steel. You're listening to Here and Now. It's Here and Now. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's a multi-million-dollar marketing campaign wrapped in an American comic book legend.
You're not just anyone, Clark. You were sent here for a reason.
The fate of your planet rests in your hands.
Man of Steel, the latest blockbuster reboot of the Superman story, opens nationwide today. We'll hear more about the movie in a minute from NPR's pop culture blogger Linda Holmes. But first, we take a look at the movie's marketing machine, which is moving faster than a speeding bullet, but not as fast as the speed with which I will stop throwing out all these awful puns. Joining us now is our media analyst, John Carroll. John, good to see you.
Good to be here.
So, Man of Steel features product placement from Nokia, Chrysler, Sears, not to mention many others. And by the way, are those Clark Kent-inspired Warby Parker glasses you're wearing?
No, they're not, actually. I haven't been able to afford those.
You're not hipster enough, I
guess. Never have been.
Well, outside the movie, there are tie-ins all over the place. Gillette has created a series of videos featuring prominent nerds, including Bill Nye the Science Guy, and they're offering their theories on how Superman shaves, given that steely beard. So here's a little bit of tape. It's the hypothesis from Adam Savage and Jamie Heineman, host of Discovery Channel's Mythbusters.
He could, like, make little pinchers with the fingernails of his hand to pluck the hairs out one by one, like, really fast.
Oh, I got one better. I like that, though. He could have the Large Hadron Collider create tiny wormholes, and they transport one whisker at a time to another universe.
So, John, what's Gillette trying to accomplish here?
Well, they're trying to engage people in these videos. There's four of them, and what they're asking is for viewers who watch them on YouTube to vote on which theory they think is the most plausible one and the best one. There's been a little kerfuffle because people are saying, we know how Superman shaves. He shaves with his heat vision and a mirror.
Beware the purists,
yeah,
right?
But Gillette's gotten 2.5 million views of these videos, so I think they're probably pretty happy with how this is working out.
But, John, a lot of movies have both product tie-ins and product placement directly in the film. I mean, you can't go through 5 minutes of a recent James Bond film without seeing actor Daniel Craig looking down at his watch, and then we get a super close-up of the watch. And the latest Great Gatsby film inspired a line of jewelry from Tiffany's and a new collection from Brooks Brothers. So what's new with Man of Steel?
The difference is the sheer tonnage of tie-ins. They have roughly 100 global promotional partners who are ponying up about $170 million. That is basically two-thirds of the budget for making Man of Steel. Dark Knight Rises, the Batman movie from last year, they had about $150 million in promotional support. So Man of Steel is really sort of setting new standards.
New standards, okay, including super bacon cheeseburgers from Carl's Jr.
Right.
And a Chrysler sweepstakes giving away two Superman cars, quote, imported from Metropolis, a play on their imported from Detroit tagline. Do you have any sense that this might backfire because it is so ubiquitous, this marketing?
Well, there's a couple of areas where it could fall short. I mean, one is the movie's gotten pretty lukewarm reviews so far. So if people are disappointed in the movie, maybe they don't want to go out and buy Keebler cookies and enter a contest that has to do with Man of Steel. The other is that these things can sort of blur together so that it's harder and harder for the marketers to keep these promotional tie-ins straight. And the other could be just promotional fatigue. It's all over the place now. We'll see what the wear-out factor is as we go along.
There have been examples in the past where it has backfired and people did get tired of it or thought that the marketing had gone too far.
Right. The Lorax had 70 promotional partners, which was a high watermark up until Man of Steel came along. Their particular problem was who they were tied in with. They were tied in with a Mazda SUV. Now, the Lorax is saving trees, right? And so what you've got is a Mazda SUV that's Lorax approved in commercials. So people were sensitive to that. And the over-commercialization, because the Lorax is aimed at kids, that became a much more sensitive point, too. I don't think that part of it will be a problem for Man of Steel, but I think that there are potential pitfalls to it.
Well, John Carroll is a mass communication professor at Boston University. You'll find a link to his Campaign Outsider blog at our website, hereandnow.org. John, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
So that's the marketing side of things, but what about the actual movie? Man of Steel isn't Superman's first cinematic makeover. He's been transformed countless times over the past 75 years on television, film, and even the stage. Joining us now to talk about how the movie fits into the larger Superman story is NPR's Linda Holmes, host of the pop culture blog Monkey See. Linda, great to have you back on Here and Now.
Oh, thank you.
So Man of Steel sounds like a grittier, angrier version of Superman than we've seen. We've got a clip from the movie, and here's Superman punishing his foe, General Zod.
My parents taught me to hone my senses, Zod. Focus on just what I wanted to see. Without your helmet, you're getting everything. And it hurts, doesn't it?
So, Linda, that's an intense Superman. You've seen the movie. What do you think?
It is a more somber and somewhat angrier version of Superman. I think that's very fair to say. It's certainly not the kind of playful Superman of the Christopher Reeve movies or the sort of bantering Clark Kent that they put in the Lois and Clark TV series in the late 90s. This is a darker story.
Well, you mentioned Lois and Clark, and that, of course, was the TV series from the 1990s.
Why won't you talk to me?
What is there to talk about, Lois? I asked you to marry me. You said no.
I didn't say never.
Because you found out something about me that you just don't like.
No, that's not true.
I mean,
what
am I supposed to do? I cannot change who I am, and I can't change what I've done.
So, Linda, a really different type of Superman here on the small screen.
It was very much in the era of TV romantic comedies, Moonlighting, and even stuff like Remington Steele and those older ones. It was really about their relationship and them bantering back and forth, and Superman was a little bit less central.
Yeah. Well, as everyone, of course, already knows, Superman first came out of comic books. How do comic book lovers feel about this new Man of Steel?
Comic book lovers are more accustomed than you might think to seeing different things done with a character like this. He's died, he's gotten married, he's had different jobs. Many things have happened to him. He's been drawn different ways depending on who's in charge. But they are very protective of certain things. I think there are going to be people who think this doesn't capture the humor that has often been present in at least some of the Superman character, and I think there will be people who find it too dark in a couple ways that I don't want to address too specifically, but I think there will be people who will take exception to a couple of the interactions that he has with villains and things like that, but they are ready for Superman to be a lot of different things.
Well, listeners, not to worry, no spoilers here, but we can't have this conversation about Superman without talking about the other major character in the story, and that is, of course, Lois Lane, who began as a hard-charging reporter. Now, here she is, played by Phyllis Coates in the first season of The Adventures of Superman, the 1952 television series.
How come you found the man behind the hangar at just the right moment to get his exclusive story when every top experienced reporter in the business was breaking his neck?
Or her neck.
Or her neck to get that story.
Maybe I'm a Superman, Miss Lane.
So, Linda, that's not exactly a Lois Lane for the 21st century, is it?
No, and she, like Superman, Lois has taken a lot of different forms at different times. My friend Glenn Weldon just wrote a book about a cultural history of Superman, and one of the things that he talks about is before World War II, she was more of a strict reporter type. And then after World War II, as they moved into the 50s, they made her more traditional, what you would think of as a 50s housewife, almost. Mm-hmm. And she was much more focused on romance and hearts over her head and things like that. And now they've pretty much returned her to a little more serious journalism. And in this movie, she is a serious reporter and a serious person, and they make some choices about how to build that relationship that make it a little easier to respect her.
Well, that's NPR's Linda Holmes, host of the Monkey See blog. Linda, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now, if you've got thoughts on The Man of Steel or anything else you hear on this super show, go to facebook.com/hereandnowradio. And while you're there, you can see a video of me sampling Soylent, that food substitute we were talking about earlier. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin Young is back on Monday. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.